Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome to another unbelievable classic replay. I'm Ruth Jackson, and this week we're delving back into the archives to bring you a discussion.
We're putting Christianity on trial.
Let's jump in on today's discussion.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be joined on the programme today by Mark Lanier and Paul Beaumont. We're putting Christianity on trial today, and for the defence is Mark Lanier, for the prosecution, Paul Beaumont. That's one way of putting it anyway. Mark is a highly successful US trial lawyer. In his spare time, he's also a keen theologian. He's the founder of the Lanier Theological Library and teaches biblical literacy at Champion Forest Bible Church in Houston, Texas. Well, his new book is called Christianity on Trial, A Lawyer Examines the Christian Faith. Paul Beaumont is our non-Christian guest today, though for many years he was a believing Christian, but he lost his faith several years ago after coming under the influence of atheists such as Dawkins and A.C. Graylings. He's the author of A Brief Eternity. It's an imagined journey of a character called Jerry to heaven and hell, and it acts as a bit of a critique of religion. So they're my guests today as we sort of enact a sort of radio version of a trial. Well, we're calling it that. It probably doesn't quite come up to the legal standards you're used to, Mark. But in any case, it's great to have you both on. Thanks for joining me today. Perhaps an introduction to you, first of all, Mark. Tell us a little bit about your background as a lawyer and how that fits in to the book that you've recently published.
Well, for the last 30 years, Justin, I've had the honor of representing people in American courts. I'm what in America we would call a trial lawyer. So I try lawsuits for a living. A lot of that's getting the case ready for court. Mm-hmm. But then I go into court and I try cases. I've done it throughout America and had a lot of fun doing it, a measure of success doing it. And
you're being very modest. I mean, the U.S. News and World Report's Best Lawyers named you its Best Lawyer in America list for 9 consecutive years and this sort of thing.
Yeah, there hopefully is some measure of Christian humility, though, in Christian radio. So I don't want to say. No, I mean, yes, I've got record verdicts in America and we've done very well. I get the joy of being the person out front, so I get all the nice press, but it means I've got a lot of wonderful people working for me and with me.
So you're a very successful trial lawyer. You know, I'll be your publicist for that, if you like, Mark.
But, okay, thank you, Justin.
Just tell us about your passion for theology, apologetics, for the book that you've obviously come up with now.
Well, I took an undergraduate degree in biblical studies, but really in biblical languages, Hebrew and Greek, and worked hard to translate through the Bible and things of that nature. For all of my life, I've loved those things biblical. I do teach. I do write. I'm on the internet weekly. I have a class of, 700-800 people who are in attendance faithfully every Sunday. It's my passion. It's my reason for living.
This is in addition to going to church. They then go
yes,
on to
your Bible
class.
Yes.
That's commitment.
Yeah.
That's encouraging.
Well, it's a lot of fun, but it's also hopefully something. You know, I'm firmly convinced that faith is something that gives illumination to life and helps explain the way things are. And so it's a chance for people to come and learn.
And you've got a fantastic sort of personal theological library, but which you kind of open up to the public as well.
We built a library. It's got about 100,000 volumes.
Wow.
And it is used right now by about 16 or 17 grad schools and seminaries as their research facility. It's open to the public. It's a lot of fun. You can walk through there and see all sorts of people you never dreamed you'd see. You'll have 30, 40 patrons a day working in the library.
That sounds incredible. But a place maybe to put on my wish list.
Put on your wish list and have your listeners check out some of our lectures. They're all online. They're all free.
Absolutely.
LanierTheologicalLibrary.org.
Absolutely. Go there to check that out. Well, time to introduce Paul Beaumont, our non-Christian guest for today's program. Thank you for coming in today.
You're welcome.
It's great to have you on. Talk to us a little bit about your background, because you're what you could call an ex-Christian. Had a faith. I think you had it in your late teens is when you became a Christian.
Yes.
And spent a good, 25, 30 years seeing yourself as an evangelical Christian. Mm. But what caused things to start to break down on that front?
Well, thanks, Justin, for having me on your show. It does feel like a nice reversal of the Christians being thrown to the lions here in such company. Yeah, I became Christian when I was 16. It was wonderful to begin with. It was exciting. I made lots of friends. I met some great people. I went to university a couple of years later and got very involved in the Christian Union. In fact, I was president of the Christian Union in my final year. I stayed in the town where I'd been to university, in Southampton, and stayed involved with the big city centre evangelical church there. Met the woman who I married, and together we ran the youth group for a number of years. So we were definitely living the evangelical Christian life. And I suppose that for me, the faith, I think, was always a bit of a mix. There was always some doubt there. I think some days I felt like I believed all of it, and probably some days I felt like I believed hardly any of it. I think that's probably not a unique experience. But evangelical Christianity makes an enormous promise, well, several enormous promises, the most enormous of which, perhaps, is that you can have a personal relationship with God.
With the creator of the universe.
The creator of the universe. Now, who in their right mind is not going to want that? So it's a great promise. The problem, of course, is that there is such an enormous gap between that promise and what people experience. And that gradually bothered me more and more and more. And when we would all go to church as a family, but churches are very ordinary. They're full of people who live lives that are quite different to the lives they would live if they really did know the creator of the universe. And even now, when I still have lots of Christian friends, I'm pleased to say, hopefully they won't all abandon me after they listen to this. And I think I quite often meet Christians who I think probably assume I'm a Christian because I'm with other Christians. But there's no difference. There is no difference.
You couldn't really find a lot of difference between the kind of life that people lived inside church who are on the outside of church.
Yes.
And if the claim is true,
then there ought to be.
There ought to be.
Yes. And I think that if I were to say why don't I believe now? Well, the answer is because of Christian witness.
Right.
It's completely inadequate.
That's interesting.
It doesn't back up the promise. And of course the biggest Christian witness is my own.
Yeah.
So things were sort of gradually slowing down over the years. But what actually tripped me into really re-examining my faith was in fact a marital crisis. Mm. As a consequence of that, both my wife and I really sort of re-examined what we believed and why. And I went back to the Bible and started reading it, I think from a different perspective, really, probably a more critical perspective, and found that the God of the Bible was monstrous, and that to believe that he was good, you had to do an awful lot of cherry picking. And I did read more broadly as well,
sure.
And really, my faith started to unravel. Yeah. And once I started to examine it critically, it unraveled very quickly. And just to finish off on the point, that when I left, it felt like a huge relief, in fact, to stop pretending. But the important point was that in all of that time examining, my wife and I, between us, I suppose, have been Christians for, I don't know, 70 man years between us. And we were never able to say, look, these problems are difficult, but don't you remember when God did this? Mm. This unequivocal thing happened, and this, and this, and this.
So and that's when I left the church,
there were no Christians who were able to say that.
Right.
You may have an intellectual problem, but, you know, there's this great new book on Christianity on Trial coming out, so you should read that, and that'll solve all your intellectual problems. But what about all of this stuff that God has done, this unequivocal stuff, and that cupboard was completely bare.
Okay. I mean, that's really interesting. I think we should address that
in
the course of what we're going to be talking about today, because that's obviously a key part of your own, you know, loss of faith. Mm. We do want to cover some of the objective ground as well, in terms of the evidential value, as we've got someone who obviously deals in evidence and so on a regular basis on the programme today as well. But if you like, the book, just briefly, that you've then written, is sort of a kind of a novel that sort of works through some of these ideas that you've had in quite an imaginative way.
Yes. Well, the novel started, I was doing a creative writing course and I had to do an assignment, a 3,000-word story. I thought, well, I'll never be able to do that. But I had this idea, inspired perhaps, to write a story about a pub quiz in heaven with Jesus as the quiz master. And all the questions are theologically based and the teams are denominational. Mm. It ends up with a great big fight between the Catholics and the Protestants because they can't agree on the answers, which I thought was really funny.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, let's see if I can develop that. And that's where the book came from. And it starts with the rapture. And, of course, many people, you know, think that heaven is a great idea. And the more I wrote about the book, I suppose, I hope this doesn't sound too pompous, the more important it seemed to become. Because it did start to examine, Justin, as you said, some of those really important issues, which is, you know, you have to be careful what you wish for. What is what is it really going to be like if some people are in heaven worshipping the Creator who has condemned the vast majority of humanity to hell? How will you live with knowing that your loved ones have been condemned by the one you are worshipping? So it was issues like that came into the book, and I was able to explore, I hope, in a funny way as well as a thought-provoking way.
Well, it's a very interesting read. So the book is called A Brief Eternity. Links to both my guests and their books from today's programme. If you go to the webpage of Unbelievable, you can listen back to today's show, leave comments, get in touch with the programme, and of course find more resources in regards to both my guests. Mark Lanier and Paul Beaumont joining me on the programme today. We're putting Christianity on trial. Christianity on Trial is the name of Mark Lanier's new book. He's a successful US trial lawyer himself. Paul Beaumont, our non-Christian guest, acting as the prosecution, if you like, in today's discussion on Unbelievable. And I wonder what you make of today's programme. Be interested to hear from you. So coming back to you, Mark, two very different books, but each making the case, in a sense, for and against Christianity at some level. I think it might be worth starting perhaps where Paul took us just then, which is this idea that his cupboard was bare when it came to the experiential aspect of Christianity. You've written a book that deals very much with the evidences and the objective sort of, you know, what do we do with the New Testament documents, with the philosophical, scientific evidence and so on. I mean, but this is probably where a lot of people start when it comes to having doubts about their faith is, I'm not sure I've ever really experienced God, or maybe those things that I thought were experiences of God, were they just my imagination or whatever? I mean, what's your general response to those kinds of issues?
I find it fascinating, and I am honored that Paul appears on a show in a sense as the reversal of roles, and I find it admirable, his honesty and his candor. But part of my heart cries out when I hear this story, because to any extent that Paul or other people have found Christianity to be disingenuous because of a failure on the part of believers to reflect a difference, it saddens me greatly. I will tell you this, and I'll tell your listeners this. I would be a radically different person than I am today if I did not believe in God.
that the presence of God in my life and the relationship with God has radically changed who I am. It changes what I do. It changes how I treat people. It changes how I father my five children, how I husband my wife. It changes it from something where I live. And this is, let me back up for a moment. This is where I start with the book. Mm. I had a conversation with a gentleman who is a dear friend of mine who called himself a golden rule atheist.
Okay.
And I said, what do you mean by that? And he says, well, I'm an atheist. There is no God, but I live by the golden rule to treat others the way I'd like to be treated. And I said, now, why on earth do you do that? If there's no God, it seems to me, in this dog-eat-dog world, you should be looking out for number one. And he said, well, I don't think that's the nature of things. And I said, Mike, have you ever studied the ocean? I said, show me a shark who lives by the golden rule. Show me. And he said, well, and I said, now, Mike, seriously, if there's no God, there's no nobility to humanity. Humanity's not something unique and special. Mm-hmm. We're simply a bag of chemicals. Why, when your grandmother died, didn't you eat her body or give her body to the poor people who don't have enough food? There are people starving in this world that could have used the protein in your grandmother's dead body. And he said, well, that just wouldn't seem right. And I think I'll close this here, but I think that the key to that is even though Paul and Mike and these other folks think that there's no real difference in the way people behave, the fact that there is a God who has made us, deep within our souls, we do believe we're special. Mm. You know, Paul does believe in his heart that it would be unfair to condemn his loved ones to hell because there is something special about a human. Mm. Notice he did not say, and Paul, you weren't worried about your dogs being killed for eternity or other animals being killed for eternity, but the idea that a human being might be extinct for eternity, which is what I understand hell to be, an extinction, that is something that really concerns you because you see a nobility in humanity. And I think that's an evidence of God itself.
Well, I think it's very interesting that Mark did not answer that question by saying, oh, let me tell you about this fantastic thing that God did for me yesterday, and then these five things that he did the day before. And just last week, I witnessed all these miracles.
Right.
It's very interesting. And Christians never answer like that.
They some would probably say, I think this happened to me, but yes, I appreciate it.
I think you would have said, no, that's not why that happened.
well, maybe, but I mean, it's not difficult to think of miracles that would certainly make any atheist think. But they don't happen. I read your book, Mark, and I read the part about the golden rule atheist. You make some errors in there, actually, about empathy. And I'd recommend you read Franz de Waal's book, The Age of Empathy. He's a primatologist, because you suggest that only humans are capable of empathy. And you make a rather spurious argument, if I may say so, about that being something that drives evolution. Humans are not the only species to empathize, interestingly. The Age of Empathy is full of great examples, particularly amongst the other apes. Now, not surprisingly, what you find, of course, is that humans are able to empathize most, and that's a consequence of our intelligence. We are the most intelligent species on the planet, and therefore empathy and altruism and so on, those things are dragged along with our intelligence. But apes are able to empathize, monkeys a little less, other mammals a little less than that. And in fact, empathy is something that completely reflects what you would expect in evolution, which is that the more intelligent animals are able to empathize more than the less intelligent.
So you're a vegetarian, animals. A vegan?
No, I'm not.
No. You're not having empathy for what meats do you eat?
Well, I eat meat.
Do you eat pork?
Yes.
And yet you're aware of the studies that indicate that pigs have empathy and the studies that indicate that pigs are intelligent. More so than dogs. Pigs can swim. They can be house trained. They can be all such things. But you would eat one. Would you eat another human?
No, I wouldn't eat another human.
Why not?
Well, because I think that we are able to treat other humans with respect.
What's unique about a human?
Well, in a sense, what's unique about a human, of course, is that we are a unique species.
In what way?
Well, we are more. Well, what do you mean in what way?
There's
We are highly intelligent.
As are apes. As
well, not as intelligent as us.
Well,
the other apes are not as intelligent as us. I mean, I don't know. It depends. I don't know what your friends are like, Mark, but I can assure you, I don't have any friends
Friends who could survive in the jungle as well as an ape. So to the extent that your intelligence test
that's just about being adapted, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, no. To the extent your intelligence test is one of, are you intelligent in a human sense? Can you do algebra? Can you do all the rest? Those intelligent tests themselves are wired for us.
But I
go back to this. So you will eat something if it's less intelligent. That's your key?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's a good challenge. You know, what actually is the difference? And in a sense, there isn't an enormous difference in that we are. I mean, if you want to put it in an extreme way, we're all a bunch of chemicals walking around in a bag. You
exactly.
Know?
So why won't you eat a human?
Well, because I suppose in a sense, it doesn't feel like that's what we are. You know, we have consciousness, and consciousness is a very mysterious thing. Quite how
probably the average pig has some level of consciousness.
Oh, absolutely. You can't have empathy without consciousness. So all of those studies about with empathy.
I wasn't drawing the difference between our consciousness and the consciousness of a pig. So of course we have consciousness, and we are actually able to make moral decisions. And we're able to make decisions about all sorts of things. And sometimes, of course, we behave with great empathy and great altruism. And sometimes we behave the opposite. You know, we are...
Human
psyche is complex.
I should have titled that the Today Show. Why won't you eat a human?
No, I'm serious. What is it? Because I do think you perceive to humanity.
I don't perceive a God-given... But that's all very poetic. But I don't think that you have to believe in a divine agency to respect life and to respect the life of people. And you say, you know, why wouldn't you eat a human? Well, in some circumstances, Mark, I think we might, and I think you might too.
No, but why would you let a dead body go to waste? Why wouldn't you be insistent on a policy when people die, take the protein and feed it to the famished?
Because we don't feel like that. You know, if somebody close to you dies, you do feel a great sense of loss, and it would feel very disrespectful. It would feel like you were attacking yourself somehow.
No.
It would probably feel disrespectful regardless of that person's relationship to you, though.
Yes,
I mean, you wouldn't do it with someone who had died,
in
front
true.
Of you. You,
that,
you didn't
that is
know.
True. But the way empathy works is that most of, you know, the strongest empathy is for our nearest and dearest. And, of course, we can empathise with people and, indeed, with animals the further away you spread from that. And of course, if it wasn't like that, you wouldn't be able to live.
Before we go too far down this road, I just want to kind of draw it maybe to a point that you're bringing it to, I suppose, Mark, which is presumably, you know, I said we wanted to kind of talk about the case for and against God at some level at the outset of the programme. And in a way, we are here, aren't we? Because as far as you're concerned, obviously, you believe Paul does have some kind of view that humans are special, unique in some way. Paul may have an explanation for that to do with his evolutionary sort of view and that kind of thing. But for you, the only real explanation, presumably, is that
we are unique.
Is that we are unique special. In some God-given way.
Yeah.
Paul says no, it doesn't
we're
have to
a bag
be.
Of chemicals.
You don't have to believe in God, though, says Paul, to believe that we're special. What's your response?
I have trouble with that. I mean, I don't see the logical consistency of your position, Paul. And here's the reason I'm saying it. You say we don't eat humans because we care. We grieve when they're gone. But I'm sitting here thinking, most people in America believe it's important to consider being a body part donor.
Yes. Yeah, sure.
So that when you die, you're killed in a car wreck. If your heart is salvageable, your kidneys are salvageable, your eyes are salvageable, your lungs are salvageable, you can sustain life to others if you donate those.
Sure.
And I don't know anybody who says, oh, but I can't donate. I don't want anybody to donate body parts because I grieve their loss. And I'm saying, why don't you donate the muscle tissue as well to help feed those people who are starving? Why don't you donate the calcium in the bones to help vitaminize those people who are calcium deficient? Why don't you take the brain and
effectively, you're only shortcutting a process that will happen anyway as the body rots in the ground and produces the nutrients for
it. Well, I mean, maybe Mark's got a great point. Maybe when he goes back to the States, he should set up a business to do exactly that.
Well, I can't because
I was going to make the point about donating body parts. And yes, I think that is a noble thing to do because it helps other people. In terms of why don't we eat dead people, I think I would say, well, actually, there isn't a need for that. And it may well be that our squeamishness about that doesn't actually have
a logical
basis. It has an emotional foundation, and you know, a great deal
but
of
this,
life
this emotional,
is emotional.
But I think what Mark's point is your emotional attachment to this importance of humans isn't just explicable by a kind of we are the most intelligent, we are the most whatever.
It's entirely explicable by that. We have an emotional connection because of the species that we are. And an emotional connection, in fact, helps our species to survive. Just as the other apes have something very similar to an emotional connection to their species. And interestingly,
Apes eat apes if you're not in the tribe.
Well, they do. But then, you know, all the apes are complex, and we are the most complex of all.
We have
empathy, but we're also highly competitive. And the reason we're highly competitive is because that's how we have survived. Evolution has selected within us this complex range of ways of thinking. We're competitive, we're empathic, we're altruistic, you know, all those things and many more make up the way we are.
Maybe we can come back to this in a moment. We're already out of time in our first part of today's programme. I told you guys it flies by. But we're going to continue debating and putting Christianity on trial in a moment's time. I'm Justin Brierley. You're listening to Unbelievable. And today, Mark Lanier and Paul Beaumont join me as we move on to, in the next section of the programme, talking about the resurrection. Paul says that as an ex-Christian, he found that the Jesus he had been told was alive simply wasn't in his experience. Well, we're going to be looking at that as well in just a moment's time.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Unbelievable show. Thank you for your support.
We would kind of, before we go on to talk about other issues, maybe just try and wrap up a bit what we were talking about there. Paul ended by saying he's convinced that there is an evolutionary explanation to all of these apparent feelings we have of the nobility, the virtue of human beings. Why for you is that not enough to say, look, the cooperation, those feelings are part of the story of why we're here now, the fact that, you know, these are all, if you might, to use a scientific terminology, adaptive traits that have enabled us to succeed and thrive and so on. why isn't that the full story for you?
Because it hasn't worked historically. And the way this conversation got started was my reply to Paul's genuine concern that if Christianity were true, then people would be different and they would act differently. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And my point was, if atheism were true, then people would act differently. People would have looked differently upon Hitler and what he was doing when Hitler is with medical testing on people who have not the high intelligence level, people with mental disability, people who have outcast in society, who arguably are genetic misfits. And so Hitler decides he'll use those to experiment to better humanity that is his group that he's looking out for. And if I think atheism were true, I would be hard-pressed to put those arguments to shame. And so Paul's discussion point that, well, no, as humans, we just empathize. I just don't see that in humanity. I mean, there are a lot of things going on in the Middle East today that demonstrate there are a lot of humans that don't just empathize automatically with others. I think there's a serious problem with that.
I do want us to move on beyond this because obviously, in the end, maybe we can come back to this issue of why you feel in the end that the cupboard was bare when it came to seeing a difference.
Just, if I may, that I did say that humans are complex. It's not as simple as that. I didn't say that all humans do is empathise. Mm. We are complicated, and of course we're competitive, which I've already said, and it's not all about empathy. Empathy is part of our character.
Sure.
But to say that Mark doesn't understand why atheists don't all support Hitler, I knew sooner or later he'd play the Hitler card.
It's
in the book. Of course it's in the book. Of course it's in the book. What I would say, though, is I think it's a bit rich, frankly, to be taught lessons on morality from someone who believes in the God of the Bible. And we really do need to examine what the God of the Bible is like.
I mean, your big issue there, let's go there then, is that how could a God condemn millions of people to hell? That's kind of, and that's obviously what you raised.
That's one of his immoral acts,
well,
certainly.
We won't have time to discuss everything, obviously, that you object to in the pages of Scripture, but I think this is a relevant one to the book. That, for you, again, was part of the reason you abandoned Christianity in the end.
Yeah, I think I always found it difficult to accept the concept of hell. I mean, many people close to me, my father, for example, had in fact, interestingly, started life as a Catholic and had given that up in his early 30s and was an atheist by the time I became Christian. So we had some really interesting conversations at home. But I found it so difficult to accept that my father, who I loved and still love, would spend eternity in hell. And I was supposed to be worshipping the God who put him there. Now, that seems to me to be, and it is something I explore in Brief Eternity, how could I be in heaven? How could that be bliss for me, knowing that people I loved had been condemned to damnation? Mark has kindly sort of toned it down to, it's just that they don't exist anymore. Well, great. How could I worship the God who had made that decision? And indeed, Mark, how could you, if one of your five children decides that Christianity is false?
It is a common objection.
How would you cope with that for all eternity, knowing that one of your daughters was actually excluded from that? And I think that's it's impossible for that to be bliss.
Yeah, I think that's an amazing question. I think it's a very perplexing question. And it's a very difficult one to answer. And I think Paul's put his finger on what for many is a defining moment. Mm-hmm. And the responses, there are lots, and I'm sure you've thought through them all, but I would throw them out there anyway just for grins. Does it ever enter into your mind? Let me ask it this way. Do you think God should force people and into making the choices that are best for them? Or do you think it's okay for people to make choices?
This is the idea when you talk about choice. Okay, what choice are you talking about? If you're talking about here's a choice. You can spend eternity in damnation with very unpleasant things being poked up your rectum by but well, unspeakable
I don't think we
demons,
see that
or whatever it is.
I mean, that's in the Bible. Okay.
Oh well, we see some pretty horrendous stuff, you know, be thrown out into the fire that you know, cannot be quenched and so on. Whatever your
right,
picture
that's
of
extinction.
Hell is,
that fire will
that never
burn
goes
up.
Out.
Okay. Right,
that never goes out.
Well, never goes out.
That doesn't sound like extinction to me. All right,
yeah, the
okay.
fire never.
Okay,
goes
so
out.
We have this much milder version. Hell, all that hell is extinction forever.
Right.
Okay, fine. Well,
which is what you believe in anyway.
As a Christian, Paul, you surely never heard a sermon in which you were told that people who go to hell are going to have pokers shoved up their rectum by a demon.
That's as much, I mean, much more to medieval art than it has to do with scripture. But nevertheless,
well,
know,
saying,
for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, Christians had a terrible vision of hell, and they
well,
get
maybe
that
it wasn't
from,
a biblical vision.
Well,
though,
they got
to be
it
fair.
From somewhere, Justin, and God should have made it clear. Said, by the way, you know, at the judgment. You know, those people who don't believe in me, all I'm going to do is extinguish their lives.
Well, that's what Scripture says.
Well, they should have made it so clear.
It's pretty clear.
That Christians should have believed that for 2,000 years, and they haven't believed that for 2,000 years. But let's go back to the
choice.
Yeah,
let's stay on the Bible and the church.
This great choice okay. that I've been given is eternal bliss or extinction. Well, who's not going to choose eternal bliss, for goodness sake? But that isn't the choice that we're given. The choice that we're given according to your theology, Mark, if I may speak for you, is do you believe in the resurrected Jesus or not? Well, no, actually, I'm not convinced by the evidence. And as a consequence of making that decision, that free decision, I don't get to enjoy eternity. I am damned forever for making that choice.
Okay, now, I think we need Mark to just, okay. before you develop any further points, okay. there's quite a few things to try and respond to.
Yeah. Okay, so first of all, you know, the Christian perspective is that people do have a choice in that what God has done is rather than just extinguish all humanity, rather than just annihilate everyone and end it all, he's made a provision where those who choose can decide that they want to spend eternity with him.
Well, who's not
now,
going to choose that?
Well, I think a number of people will look at it and say, no, I don't want a God like that. And if that's the kind of God there is who is allowing some to choose, then I'm going to deny his existence. And I think there's a group of people who are that way. And I'll go a step further. I don't know many Christians who say that you've got to have be totally convinced of the resurrection of Jesus. I mean, there's a difference between the word convinced and the word faith and believe. I tell juries all the time in every trial that the burden of proving something is not convincing everyone beyond any doubt so that there's no doubt whatsoever. It's a question, rather, of what makes the most sense and where are you going to put your trust? What will you put your trust, your faith, your belief in, which is more likely than not? And so to the extent that people make that choice and God says, okay, those that make this choice will be redeemed from extinction, I think is a marvelous blessing. And the key is you believe everybody's extinct. I mean, you think we're all out, sniff, and like that, and I don't see you standing up decrying the human state, you know? I mean,
of course I don't, because I don't believe that there's any alternative, Mark. That's a ridiculous thing to say. How can I possibly decry that?
You don't seem upset about it either, I guess is what Mark's saying.
Well, hopefully I've got a few more years left in the tank, Justin, that's why. But yes, I mean, it's a great point that you know, what happens if, as Emily Dickinson says, you know, this one life, you know, and as she says beautifully, it comes but once is what makes life so sweet. Yeah, I believe that we have one life and we're very fortunate to have that one life. And when we die, that will be it. We won't have any consciousness. Now,
so in a sense, you've lost nothing. In that sense, if you go along with Mark's view of what's called annihilationist view of hell, which is
well,
extinction.
I do think that it's really extraordinary that the Christian Church for 2,000 years has taught and has believed not in extinction for non-believers, but in eternal damnation. And suddenly, here we are in 2014, and Mark and his friends have discovered that actually that's not what the Bible teaches. I mean, that really is an amazing...
I think if you look back, there's quite a long tradition of annihilation. We need a more religious education on this point.
Come on. Oh, thank you very much. I think what you need to do is you need to educate the Catholic Church, the Greek Orthodox Church, the Protestant Church, and the vast majority of Christians since, you know, for the last 2,000 years, the vast majority have believed in hell. And even if it was only a small minority, what on earth is the matter with God who cannot make it clear what happens when you die? It's not that difficult to communicate these things. It cannot be that difficult. I could do it, frankly, and I'm not omnipotent. So why God made such a mess of it is anybody's guess.
Well, I wouldn't say he's made a mess of it. Well, I would say that humanity has made a mess.
Well, why don't all Christians agree with you on this?
Well, I think that's because different people have different views, and they're entitled to
them. Well, he should have seen that coming.
Okay, but you see, the difference between you and me is I think you want God to be a computer programmer who requires everyone to answer all of his questions just right and understand everything just right, instead of a God that's given freedom and liberty and understanding and an ability to rebel,
I just think God should be able to clearly communicate.
I mean, I do want to move on a little bit because there's a great deal more we could open up in that. But it's an interesting place to go, and I think does touch on some of the themes in your own book there, Paul. We've talked about Jesus a little bit and his resurrection. Let's maybe open that up for discussion. A good section of the book, Christianity on Trial, is concerned with the issue of Jesus' resurrection. What we heard Mark saying was, in the end, he doesn't find the evidence compelling, but even so, you know, he thinks that it's a poor basis on which to judge someone's, you know, eternal fate. But why do you believe if you can do this in 10 minutes. Why do you believe there is good evidence for the resurrection? Because if that's true, then pretty much everything turns, I guess, on that, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it's the critical issue because it's the defining moment for the last segment where Paul said, you know, what kind of God would do this? And the real question to me is what kind of God would be willing to leave deity in an eternal sense and incarnate as a human and then allow himself to be abused, persecuted, suffer at the hands of humans, would die at the hands of humans, and then, of course, sustained through a resurrection. But what kind of God would do that is not this horrible, malicious God. It's a very kind and loving God who would give of himself totally for it. So the question then becomes, could this resurrection have been real? And what I urge people to do is what I would urge them to do in any trial. It's put the evidence in both sides of the scale. Mm-hmm. And on one side, you've got something that, though it's not been an experience necessarily with Paul, you certainly see people whose lives have been transformed. Mm-hmm. I don't know any historian who questions whether or not early Christians were willing to be martyred for their faith, martyred because of this unshakable belief that Jesus Christ was God and died and was resurrected and offered eternity. And I, you know, and Paul said, if the claim is true, then people should be different. I don't know many people who would not recognize that the early church martyrs were clearly different than the most people are otherwise. So you've got all sorts of the evidence for the resurrection. On the other side of the scale, what's the evidence against the resurrection? I can only think of one thing, mm-hmm. and that is that doesn't happen to people. That's it. I mean, and that's true. I mean, you might have people come back from 3 minutes of death if the EKG, I mean, if the mm-hmm. shock is the defibrillator's working, but 3 days? Mm-hmm. And that's a valid argument. That doesn't happen to people. But that's the uniqueness of Jesus' resurrection. A, he's not just a person, and B, there is the claim of the divine that God did something spectacular in the history of humanity that has never been done before and will never be done again in the sense of a resurrection into a presence, a life that's eternal. So I think that...
Well, let's hear the prosecution from Paul. What's your case against the resurrection, if you could sum it up into a fairly short
I think the burden of proof should be with the believer, actually. But it's interesting that Mark quotes martyrs and martyrdom. well, lots of religions have martyrs and martyrdom. Are we to believe that they're all true because the early martyrs had an unshakable belief in the truth of what they were believing? Religions are mutually exclusive, at least the monotheistic ones are. So I don't think that the martyrdom holds much sway at all. I do think that it is true that if the resurrected Jesus was alive today, Christian lives would be different, and they're not sufficiently different. So that's an issue for me. But I suppose, ultimately, I think that the evidence, the so-called evidence, really exists only in scriptures, and it shouldn't do. And when we read that, we are faced with a mass of contradictory stories that do not come together. It's the stuff of legend, not the stuff of history. And in fact, if it was historically compelling, then all ancient historians would, of course, be Christians, because the evidence would be so overwhelming that they'd have no other recourse other than to believe it, and that isn't the case.
Beyond, obviously, the issue of whether people's personal lives tell a story of resurrection,
sure.
The issues are, you feel they're legendary in the way that they're written down, and if they were true, then all ancient historians would believe it and be Christians, sort of thing. You don't seem to be giving the main issue that Mark spelled out, which is that I just don't believe that happens to dead bodies. I mean, is that also an issue for you?
Well, I mean, Mark's right. If that, you know, if Jesus was God and could do miracles, well, yeah, then of course the great miracle would be the resurrection. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I get that. Yeah. I get the internal logic.
Sure. Okay. Mark, maybe you want to tackle a couple of those, and then we'll...
First of all, the idea that the resurrection is only attested to in Scripture is, in some ways, accurate, but in some ways, I would say it's not necessarily the fullest picture. I mean, we certainly have early writings that attest to at least the belief of this and the testimony of the early witnesses, whether it's the Didache or whether it's the letters of Ignatius. We also have, of course, Roman historians who are non-believers who recognize that there was Crestus or Christ. Mm-hmm. We have Josephus who writes of it, who is a Jewish historian, writes in 95. AD. And so the idea that Jesus was a fiction, of course, is wrong. The idea that there were no early believers in this, you know, you can say we only have it in Scripture. But if you look, for example, at the Apostle Paul, he's not writing the Gospels. Paul's writing his epistles. He's writing letters. And nobody doubts the authenticity of his letters. But Paul has no qualms writing to the church at Corinth and saying there are 500 people to whom Jesus appeared that are still alive today. You can go check this out. It's kind of a bold claim to make if...
And so in a sense, you treat Paul as a witness in that sense.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't know a court that wouldn't. You know, here's a man who does an entire 180. He loses his popularity. He loses his position. He's the golden-haired boy who's in tight with the high priest, who's from a family of money, a family of influence. He's had the best education. He's persecuting the church. And he throws it all away because of his encounter with a resurrected Jesus on the road to Damascus. Now, we could say Paul's a nut job, but you read his writings, and I've personally, as a lawyer, represented a lot of nut jobs, and they don't write the way Paul does. you know, he's not a nut job, and he ultimately goes to his death for his belief. He's a martyr.
I mean, so, and regarding the other gospel and the testimonies there, I think one of the things mentions is contradictions. So are these just legendary in that sense?
No, heavens no. Heavens no. I don't see them as contradictory at all. And I'm sorry, I've translated them. I've lived with them. I've written on them. I've taught them. I will tell you this, Paul. One of the things that you learn in law school as an early lawyer is if there are four witnesses to an intersection collision, and they all tell the exact same story in the exact same language from the exact same perspective, then you know that they got together and they conspired and they're lying, because nobody does that. And the Gospels aren't a conspiracy where they all got together and wrote this common conspiracy. It's
Mark, let me ask you, when the women arrived at the tomb, was the stone in place? Or had it already been rolled away?
At what point in time?
When they arrived.
Well, now the women arrive at multiple times, according to the text.
No, that's not true.
Oh,
is
it's
it?
Absolutely no. True. They arrive, they come back.
It's the same group of. Well, actually, the number of women is different. There are all sorts of contradictions in there. No. The number of women, the time of day, whether the stone was there or not, whether an angel came down and moved the stone away, the number of angels, the number of men. Whether they went into the tomb,
I think what Mark's saying is what happened
afterwards, who they met, what they were told to do. All this is a mass of contradictions.
It's supplemental information.
In that case, I invite you to do, Mark, is to write the story from beginning to end of what happened, leaving nothing out of the biblical accounts, and write that story.
I've done it, and I'll email it to you.
I look forward to reading it.
I'll be delighted to email it to you, Paul. absolutely. And I'll tell you this. The one thing that you won't find is all four Gospels, the tomb was empty. There's a great consistency
there.
That's kind of the key. Now, if we had some distinction there, if there was a contradiction there, you might have.
I mean,
would you not accept
a story, Paul, if say there were two accounts of some battle of Caesar's and they contradicted at certain points as far as you could see? Would that make you convinced that no battle took place, or just that there were some elements that obviously we're not quite sure about exactly, but you'd still probably be convinced that a battle took place, a side one or whatever? Presumably.
Yes, I mean, I take the point that if all four records, if that's the right word, were exactly the same, of course that would look like collusion. Yeah.
But what I'm saying, I suppose, is the outcome is the same. There's an empty tomb. A group of women discover it. The disciples are fundamentally changed because of it, and so on. So there's obviously whatever you might view as being the differences. Does the actual essential event, is it really?
No, I think the essential event is compromised by the scale of the contradictions, Justin. I find it implausible. I'd like to pick up a couple of other things Mark said. Actually, he said that, you know, that he talked about the Roman historian Josephus. Now, he knows that actually that passage that he refers to and he quotes in his book is highly problematic. The historians have known for a long time that there are insertions into that passage that are very, very unlikely to have actually been written by Josephus. Of course, he doesn't mention that in the book, but he does say at the beginning, you know, this is a one-sided view. He says that nobody questions the authenticity of Paul's letters, and yet he knows also that biblical scholars don't believe that Paul wrote all of the letters.
Can I deal with these one at a time?
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a few things.
Because you're going to run out of a list, and I'm going to run out of time. Let me say, first of all, authenticity, I said, of the Corinthian letter. I know that there's a dispute about the others, but I'm only referencing the Corinthian letter, so let's be precise on this. What was his first one?
Josephus. Insertions by
early
Christians.
I will agree with those scholars. There are insertions by the early Christians. I did not quote from those insertions. Those insertions that scholars question, I did not quote from in the book. I left them out of the book. The only ones that I use are the ones that 90% of scholars agree, especially the Jewish scholars, are authentic.
Well, I mean, we are running out of time on this section of the program again. Great discussion, though, guys. Thank you. It's been really, really interesting so far. And I'm sure we'll – I don't know how exactly we're going to arrive at a conclusion, because normally, I guess, in the US, you'd have a jury that would make the final decision as to how well you've made your case, Mark. And
I thought we could have a game of paper, scissors, rock.
Well, that would be best of way of doing it. Okay.
Or just a fist fight. I don't mind.
No. Now, you see, then you would have your evidence that I was no different as a Christian. You would expect me to turn the other cheek, Paul.
I was banking on it, Mark.
Yeah. Nice try.
Well, perhaps we can ask the listening audience to be our jury in that case. But thank you. It's been a really fascinating discussion thus far. Talking about Christianity on Trial, that's the name of the new book by Mark Lanier, highly successful US trial lawyer, with me in studio today. Paul Beaumont, our non-Christian guest, has been acting as the prosecution today, and he's the author of A Brief Eternity. We'll be back in just a moment's time with the final part of today's discussion. Okay, it's time for that final 5 or 10 minutes where my guests get their last chance to say the thing they've been anxious to say for the whole programme. But two really great guests who have joined me on today's programme, Mark Lanier and Paul Beaumont. And we've been talking about Mark's book, Christianity on Trial, putting Christianity on trial through the eyes of Paul, who's the author of A Brief Eternity. And we've talked about evidence for God, whether the nobility of the human state sort of is evidence for that. We've talked about why Paul didn't feel there was enough evidence during his Christian journey. We've talked about the evidence for and against the resurrection to some extent. We sort of ended up there, at least, in that last section, Mark. I mean, something that we didn't quite sort of address fully, though we've not got time to do a great deal on it now either, but is this issue of the apparent inconsistencies between the different accounts. You've said, as a lawyer, you would be very suspect of any witnesses who all told exactly the same story. But Paul has said, well, they're just too different, as far as he's concerned, to give them credibility.
Yeah, and I would urge Paul and others to read very carefully and to get some good scholastic works on the Greek. So Paul made a reference, for example, to was the stone rolled away or not when they arrived? Because when you read the gospel account of Matthew, the way Matthew wrote it, the women show up and Matthew says an angel rolled away the stone. But Matthew doesn't say it in a temporal sense, like they showed up and then the angel rolled away the stone. And you're reading it in the English, and you might think that, as opposed to him saying, now an angel or the women show up, and then he's saying, oh, an angel rolled away the stone, so the stone's not there because he's setting the scene. Okay. And so when we read it, you can read it and say this contradicts each other, or you can read it and say it doesn't. And I just think we need to be careful with those things. The bottom line, though, is all of those Gospels proclaim, and people have given their lives for this, that Jesus Christ was resurrected from the dead. And Paul is correct that there are other martyrs in other religions. You find in the Islamic world some terrorists who believe if they die, they're going to get 10,000 virgins.
I mean, one of the criticisms I think you had, Paul, was, well, if that's true, why don't all ancient historians believe it?
Yeah, well, the same reason Paul doesn't. I mean, to me, it's almost a reflection of the heart as much as it is the mind. I don't think it's an intellectual, and I can't judge his heart. I don't mean it that way, but I mean it came out bad the way I said it. But what I mean is it's where's your heart on this? Where do you desire? What do you want? And I think some people just feel like that's not where I want to go. And you can always find a reason to disbelieve anything you want. I mean, people disbelieve reality.
Paul?
Well, on the first point, Dan Barker, who you may know, wrote a great book called Godless. And in fact, he addresses specifically the point about Matthew 28, verse 2, and how it begins to address your point, Mark. So, yes, I agree. I think that it's a good idea to read broadly and to find out what most Bible scholars believe. You're a little bit unkind towards Bart Ehrman, who has written a couple of great books called Jesus Interrupted and Misquoting Jesus, which I think give a very good overview of what most biblical scholars think about New Testament writing. So, yes,
but
Bart
Ehrman, my conversations with him, has said that he believes that the disciples witnessed, had some kind of a vision of the resurrection of Jesus. He believes that there was an empty tomb. He agrees that he thinks there are contradictions, but he doesn't actually say that discredits the accounts. He just says there are contradictions.
I think ultimately you have to decide, you know, if something happened, what is the most likely explanation? Is there a natural explanation or is there a supernatural explanation? And for me, all natural explanations are more likely almost by
definition?
Well, because I think because that's our experience. You know, we've always, you know, our history as a species is that we've relied upon supernatural explanations for things.
Hold on.
And that more and more, the more knowledge we get, the more we discover natural explanations. The point about where the heart is, I think, is a very interesting point. And this is the Christians get out of jail free card, really. Because now you say that it's no longer just about the search for truth. You actually have to be searching for God. Your heart has to be right, whatever that means. Now, I can assure you, Mark, that I really tried. You know, I tried for over 20 years I confessed my sin, I invited Jesus into my heart, I repented of my sins, I read the Bible, I prayed, I worshipped, I was involved in church, and, you know, I was an evangelical Christian. I can assure you that I did all of those things and I was seeking for God, and he's not there. You know, I could not find him.
So as far as you're concerned, if it turns out to be true, God won't be able to say of you, you didn't,
well,
you,
I
didn't,
think that's,
you
that,
weren't looking for
I,
me.
I would like to address that, because I think this does strike at the heart of one of the issues which I do address in my book, which is about faith. So here I am. I'm saying to you that faith is really, really difficult. It's so difficult for me, it's impossible. I can't make myself believe this stuff any more than you can make yourself believe that Santa Claus is real, or make yourself love somebody that you don't love. It's an impossibility.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if Mark's right, and Justin, if you're right, and most of your listeners are right, the moment I die, I will see that it's true. Well, I'll believe it then, won't I? Of course I'll believe it then. Jesus is there, God's there, the angels are there. My grandma's there. Well, my grandma might not be there, I don't know. No, but heaven will be real.
Okay.
And then I'll believe it. And yet, for some reason,
that's too late.
Now, okay. That seems to me to be entirely, completely, and utterly unjust.
And I would say that you use the word belief in a very 21st century English way. The Greek word pistuo, belief, means a trust, and it's translated a trust. And I don't know even on that day that you'd say, I trust in you, God, for my salvation. And I don't
I'd
know.
Have a good start, wouldn't I? Because I believe in him. You got to believe in somebody.
You would have a mental assent. Maybe that's a good word to use. A mental assent to the reality of him. Though you may also at that point also have a great indignancy of how dare you, and how dare you? You exist and you didn't do a better job. I don't know that I don't know what the reaction may be. I don't know what the clue is. But what I do know is that God's not calling anybody to have a 100% confidence in an absolute assurance of everything there. He's saying, based upon what you know and where you are in your life, would you trust me to take care of you?
Well,
and
I,
that's what he seeks.
I can't trust him if I don't think he's real. So the first step has got to be,
and so you have
got to be that he is worthy of trust.
Are you 100% convinced he's not real? 100%.
Okay.
There's no doubt in your mind that he's 100% convicted.
Of course not. It might well be that there is a God who started the universe and then pushed off and left us to it. But that's kind of the same as not believing God's there at all. What I don't believe in is a God who is just and compassionate and kind. The God of the Bible is the God I don't believe in, because the God of the Bible is not those things. He's an infanticidal, genocidal,
well, you're reeling off the Richard Dawkins passage at this point, but
yeah.
Well, obviously,
I'm not
obviously,
quoting Richard Dawkins. Anybody who can read the Bible,
well,
and
well,
find
let's
the,
talk
and
about
find
Jesus. Why don't you use the word Jesus instead? Do you find Jesus to be infanticidal, genocidal?
Well, obviously, he didn't do those things. Although I do think he introduced us to the concept of hell. But Mark, you make a great point in your book. In fact, it's on page 89, I read it about the fact that you should not cherry pick evidence. And I think that, of course, it's possible to believe in a loving, kind, just God. And of course, the idea of somebody sacrificing their life for others is very noble. But you can only come to that conclusion of the God of the Bible if you don't read vast swathes of it. Let me just give you one example.
Well,
maybe this
I'm
one
afraid we're not going to have time to, because that is a whole debate in itself, and
okay.
I don't feel we could
do
justice to that if we opened up that particular objection at this point. We've done it many other time on the show, of course, but look, we are going to have to draw it to a close. There was something that I think you wanted to get back to. You said something that Paul said about that I couldn't believe it because it just doesn't happen in, you know, in our natural experience and so on, the resurrection.
You know, if something had happened, if God's redemption of humanity had been something that we could believe that does happen all the time, I think the general reaction of everybody would be, that's not God. That happens all the time. Why should I believe in that?
You quote the story of Polycarp as if it's historical. That when he was going to his death, he and the other Christians heard a voice from heaven. Well, I'd like to hear a voice from heaven saying, this is what really happened, because that would be at the level of unequivocal evidence.
Would it? Your brain could be fooling you?
Well, okay, guys, it would really make me think, you know. It would really make me think. Now, you know, we know about unequivocal stuff. We can believe in the sun unequivocally. And if God wants me to believe, then I want unequivocal evidence, or at least I want strong
evidence.
You
want God to almost force you to believe in him?
Well, if it's going to mean that I'm going to spend eternity blissfully happy, then why doesn't he? I mean, I'd do that for a child of mine. I'd do that for any child. If their happiness depended upon me showing them something in a way that they could be in no doubt over, then of course I would do
it. So if the 8 billion people on the world all got to – God would visit 8 billion people and spend enough time with them to answer all of their questions, do the God magic stuff for them, do whatever he needs to do, that's what your picture of God would be.
It depends. If my eternal destiny depends upon trust in God, then what he needs to do is give me reason for trusting, and he hasn't. And he hasn't done that to the vast majority of people on earth.
Obviously, you believe he has, Mark, in Jesus Christ. Obviously, you believe he hasn't.
Paul. Yeah, kind of hard.
We haven't quite managed to convert you in the course of the program, Paul.
We've got to have volume two. I need more time with Paul.
Well, look, it would be great to get you both in again. So maybe next time you're visiting the UK, Mark, it would be fun to do that. And Paul, thanks for being on the program today. It's been really interesting. Both books available, of course, and links to that from today's website.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed that discussion. Please let us know what you thought. Email us at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or leave a comment on our Twitter account at unbelievablefe or on the Premier Unbelievable Facebook page. And do check out our website, premierunbelievable.com. That's premierunbelievable.com. Thank you for listening and see you next week for another Unbelievable Classic Replay.